The Islamisation of politics in countries like Indonesia and Malaysia has been named as one of the top global risks for 2018 by a US risk analysis organisation. The Eurasia Group says after 20 years looking at global risks, 2018 is the one that they would pick for a big unexpected crisis. It cites China, US-Iran relations, the prospect of catastrophic political misjudgment and technology-related issues. But it also points to identity politics in South Asia, including Islamism in Indonesia and Malaysia. So what is the evidence? I've been speaking with Aaron Connolly, who focuses on Southeast Asia for the Lowy Institute for International Affairs. Aaron Connolly, thank you for your time today. There are a lot of fault lines to talk about that are listed in this report, but specifically this issue of identity politics in Southern Asia as being among the top 10 risks for 2018. What do you think that really means?
Well, that's a good question, and I'm not quite sure what they mean by that. They talk about increasing Islamization in Indonesia, but they don't actually go into details. And fair enough, this is, you know, a broad trend piece as opposed to a deep analysis of what's going on in the region. But I have some questions about just how much politics in Indonesia are in fact undergoing a process of, you know, quote unquote, Islamization.
I guess the things that are usually pointed to are issues of terror acts, the return of Islamist fighters from ISIS, that sort of thing, intolerance. Are they legitimate indicators of a trend?
Sure. Well, let's just start with the greatest concern, which is always terrorism. And, you know, we all have in the back of our mind the Bali bombing in 2002 and you know, subsequent violence, terrorist violence in Indonesia. But only about 500 Indonesians went to fight in Iraq and Syria with jihadist organizations over the last few years. We thought it would actually be much more. But that's about the same amount as went from Australia to Iraq and Syria. So when you consider that Indonesia has a Muslim population of around 200 million, Australia has a Muslim population of around 500,000. That's a pretty extraordinary difference in terms of the proportion of Indonesian Muslims who were in Iraq and Syria fighting with jihadist organizations. There's been increasing concern about Marawi, about the city in the Philippines that was held siege by ISIS earlier, I guess it was last year now. Mm. But there are only about 3 or 4 dozen Indonesians fighting with jihadist groups in Mindanao, which is pretty easy for them to get to. So there's not actually, we have not seen a renewal of the level of jihadist violence that we saw in Indonesia in the early aughts.
Is there any sort of polling done to tell us what people's views are around tolerance, around Islam generally in Indonesia?
Sure. And I guess it's important to mention that the background to a lot of this conversation is a series of events that happened at the end of 2016 when Jakarta's Chinese-Indonesian Christian governor was accused of blasphemy. And there were mass protests in Jakarta that brought somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million people out onto the streets, the largest protests Indonesia has seen since the return of democracy in 1998. And there was a lot of fear in Indonesia at that time that this would lead to, as the Eurasia Group report says, increasing Islamization of politics. But we haven't actually seen that in terms of support for violent or radical actions. We have tracking polls that cover the last 12 years, and there hasn't been any increase in this year's tracking poll, which was released on 15 November, since last year's tracking poll. So there hasn't actually been an increase for support for jihadist violence in Indonesia. It's very low. It's about 4 to 5%.
Nonetheless, there is concern after those demonstrations, after the blasphemy case, that there is something simmering there. If you add on top of that the economic constraints in Indonesia at the moment, I mean, the president just doesn't seem to be able to give the economy the kind of kick that it needs. Is there a flashpoint there potentially?
Potentially. And I think, you know, we have to acknowledge that the protests against Ahok last year did have an effect. Ahok was defeated for his first run at office. He had inherited the office from President Jokowi when he became president. He was running for the first time in his own right. It seemed as though he might win that race in mid-2016. He lost it. And then 2 weeks later, he was convicted of blasphemy and sentenced to jail time for that crime, to about 2 years jail time. So that had a big impact on Indonesian politics. And it also had an impact on how Indonesian Muslims see religion in terms of their politics. And so prior to Ahok's imprisonment, about 40% of Indonesian Muslims said that they would not support a Christian becoming governor or mayor of their city. And that number went up by about 8 percentage points. So we now have about half of Indonesian Muslims saying that they would prefer that someone who doesn't share their faith not become a leader of their city or their states.
Mm. And the economy overlaid on all of this?
Sure. So the economy is actually not doing too badly right now, but there are structural concerns about the economy, and in particular about inequality. And so one of the narratives that emerged out of the protests against Ahok was this argument that inequality in Indonesia was on the rise and that President Jokowi needed to do something about that. He's tackled that head on. He's presented some plans to tackle inequality. But in a society like Indonesia, that's going to continue to be an issue through the 2019 elections. And it's certain to be something that the opposition tries to use against Jokowi.
Okay, so fault lines in Indonesia, but not alarming? I mean, how would you, you know, scale of 1 to 10, I suppose?
Yeah, it was. So this is a subject of considerable debate among Indonesia specialists right now. You will talk to some people in Jakarta who are very alarmed about the way that the protests developed last year and the role that previously fringe Islamic clerics are now playing in Indonesian politics. In particular, Habib Rizieq, the leader of the Islamic Defenders Front, which used to be just a sort of a gang that went around and busted up shops that were selling alcohol, but has now come to play a bigger role in Indonesian politics and has a bigger voice. So there are certainly fault lines. There are things to be concerned about. But the data that we've seen shows that Indonesians, with the exception of these questions about whether or not they're comfortable with the Christians becoming governor and mayor, they're in general, they're becoming more tolerant over time. That's been a long time trend in Indonesia, and it's one that actually continued through the protests last year. So when you ask Indonesians, are they comfortable with Christians building a church in their neighborhood? Indonesians are becoming increasingly tolerant on that question, and that's actually continued.
Okay. Malaysia, the issue of Islamization or the use of Islam in politics in Malaysia is a very real one there, isn't it?
Absolutely. And so Najib Razak, the prime minister, has faced a corruption scandal for the last few years that has forced him to increasingly rely on narratives about Malay supremacy. He's the leader of a party, UMNO, which is the United Malays National Organization, and then a coalition that includes smaller Chinese and Indian parties. But they're not drawing much support from the Chinese and Indian communities in Malaysia anymore. And so he's really relying on narratives about Malay supremacy. And of course, most Malays, actually by law, Malays in Malaysia are Muslim. And so he's also been relying on narratives about Islam as well. And so there is a risk that the government is pushing Malaysia in a much more conservative direction in terms of Islam, despite its international rhetoric about a global movement of moderates, which they claim to lead. And we're likely to see quite a bit of that in the run-up to the 2018 general election, which Najib is expected to call probably in March or April, but has to call by July.
So do we see regionally through South Asia, Southeast Asia, you know, worrying flashpoints around the use of Islam for political reasons that, and also this really hot flashpoint in the Philippines, of course? I mean, is that a kind of an arc that's aligning that we need to deal with?
It's clear that identity politics are playing a bigger role in Southeast Asian politics than they have in a long time. And that's not just true in terms of Muslim majority societies like Malaysia and Indonesia, but it's also true in Myanmar, right? We've seen over the last few months the ethnic cleansing in Rakhine State, which is, you know, backed by a narrative about the threat that Muslims pose to Myanmar, where Buddhism is really key, very central to the national character. And so this is increasing across Southeast Asia, and it could also make international cooperation between Southeast Asian countries more difficult. Indonesia, for instance, has tried to play a mediating role in Myanmar to try and reduce the levels of violence that we've seen in Rakhine State. But they're not particularly welcome to play that role in Myanmar because many Myanmar officials will say, well, Indonesia was once a Buddhist country too. And, you know, we fear that we might end up like Indonesia, sort of overrun by Muslims. There is a paranoia about the Muslim population in Rakhine State and the fact that there is such a large Muslim population in Bangladesh next door. And that often reduces Indonesia's leverage in its conversations about Rakhine State and Myanmar.
So an interesting time in our region. Aaron Connolly, thank you very much.
Thanks, Linda.
Aaron Connolly, he's a research fellow at the Lowy Institute.